Blog Talk Radio.
I'm terribly sorry, sir, but your credit card
has
been
declined. Your unemployment benefits ran out 2 weeks ago.
What do you mean I'm overdrawn?
2 weeks ago.
I still have checks left. Checks
2 weeks
left.
Ago.
Too much month left over at the end of the money? Bad credit holding you back? Want to become a real estate investor but haven't won the lottery? Learn how to fix your credit, get out of debt, and build true financial independence with real estate in 2 hours a week. Tune in to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. She'll show you how, without winning the lottery or working 10 jobs. And here's your host, Heather Wagenhall.
Welcome to the broadcast this fabulous Saturday, October 3rd. I can't believe fall is upon us. I'm so excited. Leaves are changing. Temperatures are getting lower. Welcome to the broadcast, everyone. I'm Heather Wagenhals. You are listening to Heather Wagenhals Unlock Your Wealth Radio. For this Saturday, October 3rd, we are broadcasting live from the Log Mahal in Payson, Arizona. And it's been a while since we've been up here. And let me tell you, it is super chilly. I've got my floor heater on in my office. It's so cold. But yet again, I am a native Arizonan from the Valley of Phoenix. So if it's less than 70, I'm chilly anyway. Boy, oh boy, have we got a great show in store for all of you. It's our final key, the final key for this season. So it's also the last show of the season. And in such fashion, we are going to go out of this season in style. We have an incredible broadcast for you for Become a Voracious Reader, the last of our keys. We have Jeffrey Perala as our Investor's Edge guest this hour. And he is a commercial lender, and I've had a bunch of other residential lenders, and I've had REIT people, but we've never spoken with commercial lenders before, so I'm excited to have a commercial lender on, and we get to talk about what's changed in commercial lending since the residential bubble popped a couple years ago and how they have change their underwriting guidelines, if at all, in anticipation of their current market downswing right now, because commercial always kind of lags behind residential. And then our key guest is the world's fastest reader. I'm so excited. It's nice to really have such amazing guests for our final show. I can't believe how far we've come. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, welcome to the broadcast. And the Unlock Your Wealth radio show is brought to you every Saturday at 10 a.m. and our midweek update at 11 Pacific Standard Time. And we bring you crisis management and financial wellness tools to help everyone, man, woman, and child alike, manage their finances and attitudes for the single purpose of achieving financial independence. And our guests this week are going to reinforce these concepts, and we're going to sum things up. As always on the broadcast, we will have our regularly scheduled segments, our keys for teens, and news by the numbers. Also, nuts and bolts on how to implement this week's key into your current lifestyle to create financial independence for you and your family. But first, let's go to Minutes on Your Money. I have some neat articles that I've pulled this week, and some are fairly proximal to our Investor's Edge guest, so I'm going to save those for the end. But first, guess what's out? The Forbes 400. And I love how they entitle this, Poor, Poor Billionaires. How terrible is it? America's super rich are getting poorer. For only the fifth time since 1982, the collective net worth of the Forbes 400, and which is their annual tally of the nation's richest people, fell $300 billion in the last 12 months, evaporated from $1.5 trillion to $1.2 trillion. That's an amazing number. That's an inescapable number for me. And I like to think that I like money, and I know money pretty well, but those are inescapable numbers. But faltering capital markets and real estate values, along with divorce and fraud, has pushed down the fortunes of 314 members and drove 32 plutocrats off the rankings. Warren Buffett, he was hurt the most. He's America's second richest citizen. The Oracle of Omaha dropped $10 billion from his personal balance sheet as shares of Berkshire Hathaway fell 20% in 12 months. He is now worth only $40 billion. Okay, I think this is where the tears evoke now. Now, the price of entry fell below $1 billion, by the way, but beating out Warren Buffett for the 16th straight year as America's richest man, hello, Bill Gates, co-founder of Microsoft. Sluggish Microsoft shares and declining outside investments pushed the software visionary's net worth down $7 billion. Now, to round out the top 10, Oracle founder Larry Ellison, worth $27 billion. Walmart heirs Christy Walton, $21.5 billion. Jim C. Walton, $19. Alice Walton, $19.3 billion. And S. Robeson Walton, $19 billion even. Media maven Michael Bloomberg, $17.5 billion, and energy titans Charles and David Koch, $16 billion apiece. Other big losers are casino mogul Kirk Kerkorian, whose nest egg shed $8.2 billion in the last year. Shares of his gambling giant MGM Mirage have fallen 90% from their October 2007 high. Also hitting the brakes, Jack Taylor, Enterprise Rent-A-Car founder, his fortune is down $7 billion as the travel industry has slowed and private company valuations have fallen. Okay, we have a new member with Madoff ties. Former New York attorney and accountant Jeffrey Pickhauer makes his debut with a net worth of $1 billion, a longtime investor with Bernie Madoff. He's likely to be worth billions more because it says that he was able to extract his billions before the fund collapsed. Now, just to give you an idea of some people who are no longer billionaires, Sanford Weil of Citigroup, he's off the list. Frank and Reno Fertitta have 40 Las Vegas casinos and the Ultimate Fighting Championship. Nope, not on the list. Jorge Perez, real estate developer, and he's a big fundraiser for Democrats. He's off the list. Peter Thiel, New York Clarium Capital. He's the founder of PayPal. And R. Allen Sanford, the Ponzi scheme that are charges against him for some Houston banking fraud, he is off the list too. What a shame. Let's have some tears and some crying. Oh, isn't that sad? All right, enough. I'm not going to mourn any more billionaires. We need to work on building our wealth. My favorite gal, Liz Pulliam Weston, writes in The Basics, Inflation, Who Wins, Who Loses, and How to Cope. Right now, there are more home sellers than buyers, more jobless than job openings, and more factories making goods than buyers buying those goods. And she says it's easy to see why prices, if not falling, have all but stopped rising. And, well, who doesn't like lower prices? She brings up economists, for one. Deflation is what took hold in the Great Depression, leading to lower wages, higher unemployment, and more loan defaults. It gets tougher to pay your debts when you have fewer dollars to do so. And deflation tends to feed on itself. Once it takes hold, it's hard to stop. Now, the good news is that many economists think that the biggest deflation risk has stopped. The government has poured over more than $1 trillion with a T dollars into the mix to prop up jobs and home prices and consumer spending. But we'll see what happens once the economy starts to pick up, because the concern is that where there will be lots of dollars chasing after goods and services and more willingness to spend them, which is going to bid prices up. So we're kind of concerned here. And who hurts, who prospers? She says, if you don't remember those days, you have plenty of company. More than half of the U.S. population is under 40. So either they weren't born or they were just kids when inflation took its biggest bites out of their parents' budgets. So they weren't able to really comprehend what was going on. And because so many of us have never dealt with serious inflation and the rest of us are out of practice, it's time to review the basics. Who wins and who loses? People on fixed income, Social Security, and disability might have cost of living increases built in, but those lag the inflation rate, which can spell some tight times. The poor also have problems. The less money you make, the more your budget is spent on basics such as food, shelter, clothing, and transportation. Holders of long-term bonds. Rising rates drive down the value of older, lower-paying bonds, and the longer the term of the bond, the bigger hit you can take. And people with variable rate debt. Interest rates aren't fixed on most credit cards and home equity borrowing, so many mortgages with adjustable rates as well mean rising payments. But the winners? Folks with fixed rate debt. It gets easier to repay with the ever cheaper dollar, and those who have investments that can beat the rate of inflation. So here's what she recommends as your inflation game plan. Don't rush to pay off your fixed rate debt. Pay off the variable interest rate first. Be aware of locking in low interest rates on savings, because those CDs, unless they're maturing every few months, you could be missing out on other dollars that you can move your money into if it's locked up. Get ready to substitute. Prices for different goods and services rise at different rates, which means shoppers can be savvy and they can have the opportunity to substitute cheaper items for more expensive ones. Eggs rose nearly 50% after Hurricane Katrina devastated many of the nation's poultry producers. Also, weigh in the cost of procrastination. Today, consumers are being rewarded for waiting, but delayed buying that computer, for example, means you might get a better, more powerful one for cheaper next year. Get real. Investments in so-called real assets like real estate, natural resources, and commodities can help you hedge against inflation. Don't go overboard, though, and stay invested in stocks. The slightest hint of accelerating inflation will send stock markets into a tizzy, which has given some investors the mistaken notion that equities are a bad place to be in an inflationary environment. And that is just not so. Now, how about an article that's more relevant to our guest today? And that is multifamily apartments. I have always been, if you have been a routine listener of this show since 2003, a mega fan of multifamily apartments. Now, this has been the best hedge in these tough and economic times for commercial real estate. Everybody's heard of the problems in commercial and retail lately, but multifamily just is hanging in there. According to the National Association of Realtors research economist George Rathieu, while almost every type of commercial or income property has had rough going the past couple years, the rental apartment sector continues to maintain a stronger performance compared with other sectors. You want to ask me why? I'm going to tell you. Not everybody needs to open a store, but everybody needs a place to live. I'm going to sum up that article for you in those two sentences. Everyone needs a place to live. And on that note, let's move into our Investor's Edge segment by introducing our Investor's Edge guest, Jeffrey Perala. He's the managing director of Real Estate Capital Company, a national commercial and multifamily lender headquartered in Charlotte, North Carolina. Jeff manages the company's underwriting, closing, and secondary markets departments. He previously held senior positions at Impact Commercial Capital Group, SunTrust Bank's Commercial Real Estate Group, and J.P. Morgan's CMBS division. Jeff's background includes over 20 years of commercial real estate finance, including income property lending, acquisition and development loans, underwriting, loan portfolio management, and CMBS compliance. Jeff has been a featured speaker and panelist at numerous industry events and is a national instructor for the National Association of Mortgage Brokers. Now, his website is www.recapitalcorp.com, and he is going to, in addition to his litany of fabulous experiences, grace us with his presence today on our show. Jeffrey, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm a little upset that I did not make the Forbes 400.
Yeah. You were the one that just, you were at like 401, right?
Yeah, it's all that commercial real estate.
I've been sitting at 399 myself, and I'm just really discouraged, and I'm like, oh, shed a tear for me.
I must have missed a few shows. That's probably why I didn't make the list.
Oh, you give me too much credit. No. Goodness gracious. I wish I was on that list. That is my goal. Someday it'll be in boldface type, Heather made the list. And you know what? Wouldn't that suck if we fell short? How crappy would that be just to be a multimillionaire as opposed to a billionaire or a multibillionaire, as the case may be? I'm so excited that you're on the broadcast. I read an article of yours, and I can't remember where it was, maybe in the Urban Land Institute or something. I saw an article, and I was so impressed with your writing style and your ability to communicate the essence of really what is going on that I thought, you know what, this guy isn't just blowing smoke to keep the industry shored up. He's really kind of telling the truth, and I thought, this is the guy that we need on Investor's Edge, because this segment is the segment where people tune in that are already real estate investors. They have their ducks in a row. They have their sinking funds. They're properly capitalized, and they're either starting out or have experience investing in maybe residential or residential multifamily, and they're looking to take their game to the next level. And as an Investor's Edge guest, we can talk in somewhat jargony speak regarding the industry. And I've done commercial lending. I ran a commercial brokerage here in Arizona for some time before being picked to start a real estate concern for a former pro basketball player. And I was really excited because I liked commercial lending over residential lending because people were focused on different things. And I wasn't having a real estate agent call me because the color of the carpet or the drapes didn't meet their concern and they changed their mind. And I'm like, buy new curtains, buy new carpet. It's not that difficult. But you don't have people emotional about the property itself, but they're emotional about the prospect of making money. And that's what I wanted to be involved in. And that's why I was a commercial lender. And that was like 6 years ago now. I've been away from it for some time. Given what's gone on in the residential mortgage markets and what's been happening since 07 and knowing that commercial lags behind, commercial was always a little bit more astute. Has much changed in the commercial mortgage markets since the downfall of the residential industry?
Tremendously, and thank you for the compliments before as well. The industry has changed so much that we all talk about throwing away the rule book, because what used to be just as early as perhaps 2 and 3 and 4 years ago, during the height of this real estate boom, however short-lived it was, banks had a hard time. In fact, borrowers had a hard time making a mistake in real estate. It just seemed that if you were making an offer, you only had so long to get on the bandwagon before the bandwagon would leave. And unfortunately, there was a tremendous impetus to buy property. Oftentimes, you had bidders buying up properties and bidding up properties, paying more than market value. On the residential side, of course, it's intangible. You talk about the drapes and the carpeting. On the commercial side, it's always been a little bit of a different flavor because you're talking about tangible assets and you're talking about people who buy real estate predominantly for the income that it produces. The article that you were speaking about, it's kind of funny that you even mentioned that. I've been an advocate of writing articles over the past 10 years or so, specifically within the investment venue, to demystify the process of underwriting. For years, it's always been the good old boy network, where you really didn't know what happened behind the bank's closed doors. And I think over the last 10 years, we've tried to change that a lot. This, ironically, is the first article that I wrote that was a downtrodden article. There's always been a tremendous amount of hope. There's always been a tremendous amount of excitement in investment real estate. You speak about multifamily. Ironically, the numbers lag a little bit. Multifamily right now carries one of the highest default rates across the asset classes. And it's a little bizarre. You would normally
just because of the way the debt is structured, though. I mean, at least here in Arizona, I can't speak to the rest of the world, but here in Arizona, what we have seen is you got a lot of mom and pops with wrapped mortgages and second and third place mortgages that are causing defaults here in Arizona, not necessarily, you know, the traditional underwriting because the debt's been around so long. I think at least that's what we're seeing here. I can't speak to the rest of the market.
That is a lot of it in terms of the capital stack, but I think, and no one's really been able to identify specifically what's caused this or what's been the catalyst, but I think it may have something to do with the fact that we had a lot of overbuilding in condos. If you believe in a theory of retail follows rooftops, essentially what that says is whenever you have significant residential subdivision development, commercial will follow that, almost like a planned unit development, typically what you see in Southern California. And I think what has changed the multifamily landscape tremendously, while it's still a safe haven, we believe, from an underwriting standpoint, it is the least critical asset class in how we underwrite, meaning you can leverage up a property on the multifamily side. There's still a secondary market for multifamily loans where essentially on the commercial side, where commercial includes office, industrial, retail, hotel, self-storage, different products like that, multifamily has experienced a shift. I think part of that is because you've had condo developments and condo developers who have gone bust. Essentially what happens then is you have a developer who needs to create principal reductions and principal curtailments. You've got banks that are making those requirements upon the developers. You also have banks who have taken into REO their real estate-owned portfolios. They've foreclosed upon these developments. And in short, they're selling these individual condos to first-time home buyers at rock-bottom prices. What adds to that is Obama's $8,000 tax credit as well. So I think if you add all of that up, it has created a little bit of shift in multifamily. Typically, the tenants of a multifamily property are first-time homebuyers. They are pre-first-time homebuyers. So I think that you've seen multifamily vacancy rise because of these programs. But certainly across all of the asset classes, boy, that book has really changed. The way that we used to underwrite 2 years ago, even a year ago, is so significantly different than what it is now.
Hmm.
2 years ago, 3 years ago, and prior to this, and even going back to my days at J.P. Morgan and prior to that, 10 years ago, where we were making loans to book these loans and securitize them in the secondary market. And we weren't living with those loans, much unfortunately, and I'll draw a parallel, it was somewhat tantamount to the residential lending side where lenders were making loans not to hold those loans in their portfolio and service them, but rather to sell those loans in aggregate for a premium.
Yeah, seasoning them. That's all we did is we'd season them for 3 to 6 months and then sell them off.
The good part about that is that you no longer maintain a liability. You've sold that loan and you've made a profit. What we found out is, well, that's probably not the best model in a staggered, a flat, or a decreasing market, because then you have originators who are making loans and lenders who are making loans to make money off of the sale of those loans and not for the long term. I tend to think that if you're going to cut a check, you cut a different check when you know that you're going to live with that loan, as opposed to knowing that you have a secondary market that will buy that loan, essentially regardless of its tenure, its seasoning, and even its caliber or quality of origination and underwriting. That has changed so much right now. On the multifamily side, you really only have two venues in the secondary market. You've got Fannie, Freddie, and HUD. Freddie Mac, not so much. Fannie Mae still buys a lot of multifamily product. In fact, they're about the only secondary market lender that will buy loans originated from other banks, provided that they meet the minimum underwriting. They Fannie on the residential side will do condos, but not on the multifamily side. They will not. That's another reason the condo market has skewed so tremendously.
Well, I know that here, condo conversions started to become like the deal. And we had, you know, I don't know, I think that every wacky thing in real estate starts in Arizona. Because it started with the RTC. And this condo conversion thing started, and we lost a ton of inventory to these condo conversions. So, you know, vacancy rates went to nothing, which was so great, but then property values started to escalate. And then as they couldn't sell these because they over-improved them, they put in granite countertops and stuff like that in, you know, entry-level housing neighborhoods or the low-income neighborhoods, and they didn't care whether or not they had granite countertops, but where they were paying, you know, $350, $400 a month for, you know, an apartment in rent, they could not go out and now pay $1,100 a month for a mortgage just because it was overimproved and they really tried to gouge the low-income person. And so now all that inventory, as it got repoed, kind of flooded back to the market now as rental real estate. And so now we have an overabundance in the multifamily communities. And you know, our multifamily market got kind of just really ruined with all of that that went on in the early and mid-2000s.
It has in Arizona, most specifically. In fact, Arizona is what Fannie Mae calls a pre-review market, wherein with Fannie Mae, much like the residential side, Fannie Mae approved lenders are able to write loans that will subsequently be sold to Fannie Mae in areas including parts of Texas, Arizona, Ohio, the Rust Belt areas. We no longer have that ability to just write those loans with carte blanche. We have to submit those loans to Fannie Mae for a pre-approval. And unfortunately, what that pre-review status also requires is a low loan-to-value. So where in normal parts of the country, and by normal I mean parts of the country that have not been significantly impacted economically and from a real estate perspective, those Fannie Mae loans can lever up to 80% loan-to-value, where you can refinance essentially.
Stable markets, you mean?
Generally, more stable is probably a good way to put that. And stability in terms of demographics and of vacancy and of foreclosure, and there's a lot that really goes into that, including the MSAs and general population and linkages to other cities with large populations. But in the pre-review markets, the maximum loan-to-value is 55%. So think about that. That means that in many markets, a borrower can still buy multifamily real estate and put down 25%. In the pre-review markets, where we know essentially the banks are out anyway, the banks are not really making loans across the country. We can certainly talk about that next, because I think it definitely it warrants a discussion, because many people who own investment real estate either are having issues or may have issues, if not self-imposed issues by virtue of their own real estate and its performance, but also potentially from the banks who are presently holding those notes, who are coming under scrutiny by the regulators, the OCC, the FDIC, and the OTS, who are causing them to decrease their holdings in commercial real estate and write down their book values of those assets, which ultimately means the banks are not lending. Mm-hmm. But to get back to this LTV issue, where in most markets a borrower would need to put down 20% to buy a multifamily asset, in the pre-review markets you're looking at 40-50% of cash down to buy an asset.
On cash return.
It does. It absolutely does. It's got a significant impact. Hey, you know, the long and the short of this is we're in a mess in terms of commercial real estate all across all of the asset classes. Hotel right now has the highest default rate. We're likely going to see foreclosures in hotels hand over fist. I think
just foreclosed here.
I'm sorry?
The W Hotel that they just opened, it wasn't even open a year. They foreclosed on it. They're leasing it back, fortunately. but they postponed the foreclosure sale twice, hoping that they could get somebody to come to the table. But you're totally correct. I mean, the W got out from underneath the debt and didn't lose their hotel, which was good for them because it's a quality property here for us in, you know, the resort and conference market that we have here. But you're right. I mean, there's two more ready to go, two more hotels here in Arizona, big chain ones ready to go down.
You're right, and line them up because it's going to be one after another after another. We can no longer even finance hotels at this point. It's going to be very, very, very difficult to do that. And we will see pervasive losses. There's no question about it. And it really comes down to the fundamentals of real estate and real estate investing. 5 and 6 and 7 years ago, it was very easy to fully leverage a property, to get 80% loan to value on a minimal cash flow stream. Now it isn't that way. We've had a lot of externalities that are working against us, not only in terms of the economics of real estate, but you've got to think about what's happening in the industry. And if you draw a parallel to the residential side, while there, I think, are few parallels that you can draw because they're very, very different and they're very, very disconnected, supply and demand is significantly an issue. And if you go back in just about 10 years ago and you think about all of the loans that were made in the securitization market, that's generally the companies that are the Wall Street companies, the conduit lenders that make these loans, send these loans in aggregate to the rating agencies where they're essentially rated, if you will. And we all know what the rating agencies do, at least what they're supposed to do. And then in turn, these instruments are created into bonds, and bond buyers buy the bonds of which the real estate is the underlying asset. Well, those loans from 2000, 2001, 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, even 2007 were written at 80% loan to value at a 120 debt service coverage. That means there's a 20% cushion of additional cash flow that a property throws off on top of all of the requirement to pay the debt service, your principal, interest, taxes, insurance, operating expenses, and your annual debt service. Well, at those times, we had high rental rates. We had relatively low expenses. Now what you're finding is that because so much of this debt is going to be rolling and coming due, there will be almost $2 trillion of debt that will need to be refinanced within the next couple of years that will have no ability to be refinanced for two reasons. One, it doesn't cash flow. And secondly, even if it did cash flow, lenders don't have the capital to be able to make loans on those properties. So I think fundamentally you'll see a large shift in ownership of real estate. I would argue it could potentially be a bloodbath. Cash is king right now. Unfortunately, that's always been the case, but now more so than ever.
Yeah, well, I've always said credit is cool, but cash is king. What do you think about this? Last week I saw an article in the Business Journal about REITs. And, you know, being in Arizona, a lot of the big REITs are from here. One of the things that that I saw or that I thought was interesting in this article, it says that that public real estate investment trusts have access to capital and are ready for action. Do you think these borrowers that can't get money because it just doesn't exist in the commercial market are going to start applying to these REITs? I mean, somebody's going to end up with these properties. Who do you think that somebody is?
The answer to your question is twofold. The answer is yes, and the answer is no. There are essentially two types of REITs. There are regular real estate REITs, real estate investment trusts, that purchase assets. There are also mortgage REITs, and we're in the process of creating a bridge mortgage REIT at this point right now to help borrowers finance the properties that need to be refinanced, that are cash flowing, that have no other access to debt capital. So what we're doing is providing financing. That's on the mortgage REIT side. Borrowers will be able to apply to companies that are mortgage REITs because they do have access to capital, and that those loans that are made are going to be held on book and serviced as investments as opposed to being sold into secondary markets. So the purview is quite different there. REITs in general, real estate investment trusts who purchase hard assets, are going to be different. They're filling their war chests right now so that they can come in and buy properties at vulture prices. So they're going to be looking to acquire assets at significantly reduced values so that they can hold those properties until the market turns. They may reposition, re-tenant, and re-tenant those assets, revitalize the cash flows, and then at a later date, which is likely going to be 3, 4, 5 years out, the values will likely have recovered significantly, and they will then be able to sell those properties at a tremendous profit. Mm-hmm. So the REIT structure right now, and you'll hear a lot about REITs. You've heard a lot in the last 2 months, 3 months perhaps. You're likely going to hear a lot of press about real estate REITs as well as mortgage REITs, because they're about the only entities or vehicles that have the ability to raise debt and equity to make these types of plays. The banks are done for all intents and purposes. They're done. Banks have held loans on their books. The regulators have caused the banks to write down those assets. When they do that, it impacts their asset liability mix, their risk-based capital ratios. The long and the short of that is, and no one really needs to know what all of these terms mean other than the banks are strapped right now. Banks are looking to lay off their loans on anyone who will take them. Why is that important? Well, it's certainly important to the viewers, to the listeners, because many property owners who own investment real estate, multifamily, office, industrial, retail, and so on, who presently have loans at their local banks, may very well be able to or may be required to go to those banks, and those banks are allowing and offering to borrowers a significant principal reduction if they take their loan elsewhere. What does that mean? That means that if you own a multifamily property and your property is worth theoretically $1.5 million and you have $1 million note at your local bank, that bank, by virtue of the OCC and the regulators' regulations, may have to raise capital. They can do it by selling CDs. They can also do it by removing loans from their books that have been written down. So they may offer that borrower a $200,000, $300,000 principal reduction and say from the banker, "Mr. Borrower, I know you have your loan here. I know your outstanding principal balance is $1 million. However, we will reduce your principal balance to $700,000 if you go refinance your property elsewhere." The reason they need is there are a number of reasons. The primary reason is they need capital. A secondary reason, and in most cases this is a secondary reason, I guess you could argue that these reasons will change character and precedence, because some banks have to unload the real estate, and therefore they're being forced to do it. Others are doing it in an effort to just increase their capital ratios. But you're going to find that becomes very prevalent. The issue is you got to find somebody else to refinance your real estate.
And so who else is going to take that on? But, you know, if they can figure out some of the value back, the other bank, here's a question I have. Because right now I know that there's a building where somebody hasn't paid their mortgage, and the mortgage company doesn't want to file default on this person. They've allowed this person to continue to occupy, and it would meet my needs. And so I've called the bank, and I've asked to buy that note at a discount. And they're like, "Really?" And I've never done that before, but I thought, you know, I can't buy it at a foreclosure sale because they won't foreclose on this guy.
Mm-hmm.
They're just letting him kind of hang out there because of whatever it's going to do to their books. And I know that they're concerned about this because this was a bank that's been taken over by another bank. And so the bank that currently holds it isn't the one that made the note. But they've been more than willing to work with me, and they asked me what I wanted to offer, and I said, "Well, what do you think you can do?" So I put it back in their court, and I'm going to get whatever their bottom number is and still try to lowball them, and I bet they'll do it. I bet they'll do it. I'm so close on this thing. They've never said no to anything I've said so far. And I thought, is it just on this loan, or is this something that's going industry-wide? So I guess my question is to you, this TARP money that's making these banks whole on the residential side when they do the write-downs for these people doing mortgage modifications? Are these commercial banks able to get restored too if they take those write-downs?
In my opinion, TARP and TALF will have just about zero impact on a bank's ability to make commercial loans.
Oh, that's the bummer. I mean, they might as well go universal. I mean, you know, if you're going to take money from the people that make money for this country, you know, and take their taxes and reallocate it, at least let them get some benefits so they can go out and continue to make more money to be taken.
Well, the problem is if you as a bank take government money, the government essentially gives that money under TARP and TALF to allow balance sheets to recover, to become somewhat healthy, which in turn is supposed to incentivize the bank to make loans, right? That's the theory of TARP and TALF. Unfortunately, the banks want capital. The banks need capital. The banks do not want to make loans on real estate, most certainly investment real estate. The government cannot require the banks to make loans, otherwise it's nationalization. And if you nationalize the banking industry, I mean, you could argue that that's almost happening right now. If you look at the Ken Lewis debacle right now and you take a look at all this money that's been out there.
And all the resignations that have happened over the last
year. The long and the short of it is it doesn't matter how much money you give the banks. The banks are not going to lend until they have a good reason, a business reason to lend. It cannot be forced upon by the government or any other body. Otherwise, it's nationalization. That's the last thing that we need for this industry.
Well, I know, because, I mean, everything is becoming, or they're attempting to nationalize everything. You would think with the examples of all of these other fallen countries that they would say, wait a minute, why are we going down that same road? We didn't need to. But that's a whole other discussion for another show.
Right. Well, and I do believe, by the way, I'm not anti-TARP and TALF. I think there's a reason for it. I think it did shore up some balance sheets, and I think that it did do a lot of good. Frankly, I think it was required. However, I think the way that it was portrayed and rolled out to the public was incorrect and rather nebulous, because it has not, it will not, under its form, provide the impetus to make banks lend, unfortunately. And in my opinion, nothing will until the market begins to turn. Arguably, we've seen the bottom in some residential markets. I'll believe that when I see more data. On the commercial side, unfortunately, I think the worst is yet to come. I think we're going to see a lot more pain before we see things get better. And that's across all asset classes.
And what kind of bothers me, I think, is to watch all of these community banks fold because the government is only concerned with these big banks falling apart, and all these community banks that were more responsive to borrowers' needs made better quality loans, in my judgment, because they were able to assess local markets and understand the dynamics of the individual industry. Where a national bank would say, I'm going to pass on this, but a local bank could understand the needs of that commercial buyer much better. And those banks are the ones that are getting swallowed up. And I mean, there's been, what, 100 community banks close in the last
year? And you'll see hundreds and hundreds more. While I would like to completely agree with you on that, I can tell you that we've looked at the books of a number of these smaller community banks, and while they often know the submarkets much better than the national scope lenders do, I think a lot of local lenders have been under the ether. I think they've been making relationship loans where they should have been making loans that were based upon financial merit. I can tell you that we've been asked to bid on loans and portfolios. When we take a look at the underlying underwriting of these assets, it would frankly surprise you to see the lack of professionalism and the lack of intelligence in a lot of underwriting. You would think that these deals are done in a handshake.
Yeah, you know, my experience with the commercial banks here, at least in Arizona, have been fairly conservative, but maybe I've only been knocking on the wrong doors. Who knows? But something interesting you said earlier, and I'd like to circle back around to that idea and talk about that for a bit, was that you mentioned when you write, and I've written for numerous real estate publications at, you know, when I was a lender and actively lending, and my goal was to demystify underwriting. Why do people need to think that some magic is going on back there? Because how do they know that they're not in the right criteria? And so I thought, why? And part of my keys to riches system and the way I structure people to reduce debt and build wealth, I use generally accepted underwriting guidelines for conforming conventional ratios. And I thought, why wouldn't a lender want people to know what they need to qualify? That way you don't have all these people that don't qualify applying for loans and not understanding what's needed, and they just kind of say, well, I think I want to buy a house. I think I'm ready. And they have no idea what being ready and prepared for the opportunity of home ownership or real estate investment is all about. And tell me more about, you know, underwriting guidelines, and specifically, you know, we talked a little bit about the review markets and multifamily now. What do people need to know about underwriting guidelines in the commercial industry to help create the opportunity for them to maybe vulture down on some of these foreclosed properties and be able to pick up a steal? What do people need to know that's different underwriting-wise buying foreclosed properties versus just buying one that's straight up on its income and its asset mix?
I'm not sure that there is a significant difference, whether it's a foreclosed property, whether it's a property that is distressed, or whether it's a performing property that's presently on the market. The bottom line to it is it comes down to cash flow. And I think that's what really throws a lot of people. You know, the guys like Carlton Sheets that are out there that have been putting out these infomercials in these programs, however characteristic they may be, they're frankly worth a lot because they talk about and exploit the fundamentals of income-producing real estate, and that's net operating income. I think anyone who's out there looking at buying investment real estate should look at it for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is the cash flow that the property throws off. So when you look at any investment real estate, you've got to look at what's in place right now in terms of rents, what will likely happen in the next coming years in terms of rents, and then take a look at the expenses. Are expenses reasonable? Are they stabilized? Are they fluctuating? Is it likely that heating oil, the cost of heating oil, will increase within the next couple of years? Does a property require repairs and maintenance, or what we call health and safety or deferred maintenance, items that need to be addressed immediately? Will those repairs have an effect on tenancy? And then once you can, if you will, normalize the income and the expenses, you'll arrive at your net operating income. That's the cash flow. That's the bottom line. It's what the property throws off. What you need to look at then is, what's that dollar amount? If it's $100,000 a year, then you need to take a look at, well, what type of a mortgage can I get at what amortization, and what will my annual debt service be? If my annual debt service is $100,000 a year and my property throws off $100,000 a year, then I'm at what's called a 1.0 debt service coverage. That's pretty risky. That means if you have a vacancy, or if you have to replace a sidewalk or a roof or a heating system, you've got to dip into your pocket. Lenders won't do that. Borrowers ought not do that either. But if the property throws off $120,000 a year in net operating income, and the annual debt service, meaning the mortgage payments after all expenses, is $100,000, then you've got $20,000 extra to play with. Frankly, that's the ratio that most lenders will look at a minimum, is a 1.20 debt service coverage, which means you've got a 20% cushion of cash to manage economic issues such as decreased rents, increased vacancies, increased expenses, evictions, different things like that. So it really comes down to cash flow. I think if you're savvy, not only do you look at what's in place right now, but you've got to make some projections of what happens when the big box retailer down the street goes dark, and what happens when the strip center that presently has four vacancies goes to eight vacancies. These are the things that you need to look at so that you don't get caught with your pants down out there, frankly. You've got to make sure that you're fully covered. You've got to make sure that you're making some smart decisions. I don't think you should ever buy anything on impulse. I think you really need to take a close look at the numbers the seller provides. And in addition, you've got to do your diligence on it. You've got to go out into the marketplace and you've got to look at other properties. You've got to look at not necessarily comparable sales, because frankly, that means nothing in this market. I would argue that cap rates right now mean nothing in this market. Is it an 8, a 10, an 11, a 6? I think that...
If it's not cash flowing, it doesn't matter.
You're right. If it's, and that's why you need to look at cash flow as opposed to buying at a cap rate. You know, when I used to appraise, and in fact, even at our credit meetings, we often talk about the PFA method. Where did that cap rate come from? PFA, plucked from air. And frankly, that's what you see. You see a lot of that because, unfortunately, the only way that you can contrive and arrive at a cap rate is by market-driven sales. And the only reason or the only way that you can facilitate a cap rate on market-driven sales is quantifiable sales numbers and quantifiable income and expenses. And let me tell you, it's extremely difficult to find out what a property's net operating income is unless you're running it.
Yep.
So it really comes down to being savvy in the marketplace, knowing the market, knowing the influences of that market, and it helps if you're local. That's very important. Right now, Fannie Mae essentially will not make loans to borrowers who are out of market.
Right. And that makes sense. We're at the end of our time. What one thing do you think you could leave our listeners with that would make the most impact when applying for or trying to utilize commercial financing?
Well, I would say don't just ask, but ask intelligently. If you're looking for a loan, you've got to have some ammunition as to why you should be approved. The primary reason that you should come up with is its net cash flow and the cash that it's throwing off and your ability to weather a storm. I think if you're able to communicate and convey that impression upon a lender, you will likely get that loan if, in fact, the lender has the balance sheet to be able to do it.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. How can people get a hold of you? What's your website?
The website is Real Estate Capital Company, recapitalcorp.com or recapitalcompany.com. Borrowers obviously are welcome to give us a call. We've got offices across the country, and we lend in all markets.
Great. And for those of you that are unable to write it down, you can always find links to our guests' websites at www.unlockyourwealth.com. Thanks so much, Jeffrey, for joining us on a Saturday and taking time out of your day to be a part of our broadcast. It's everybody's favorite segment. Yes, it is that time for the Millionaire Minute. The Millionaire Minute is a segment where we will crawl into the heads of top millionaire thinkers and put out 60 seconds of tools you can incorporate into your life right now today. And this is from debtguru.com. And number one, remember, money means work. Being wealthy is a full-time job itself because you have to keep track of where your money is and what it's doing at all times. Number two, know where your money is going. Would you think of a company that had a large percentage of its income unaccounted for each quarter? What would you think of a company that was completely unprofessional? Would it be definitely doomed? Much money is frittered away here and there, so you got to know where your money is going. Number three, budget wisely. Be aware of what you can do to cut expenses here and there. Put away the money that you save by investing it or storing it in an account. Not every wealthy person drinks champagne like water. Any of them like water just fine. That's how they became wealthy. Number four, get rid of all debt. I can't stress this enough. You can't enter the race to wealth until you've gotten to the starting line of initial financial stability in the first place. Debt starts you off several feet behind. You have to start off with a clean slate to be able to begin to amass your fortune. Number five, compound interest is your friend. Compound interest is interest paid on the original amount deposited and on the additional amount accrued. Even if you don't think you can set aside enough money to make it worth it, you can. One example, if at the birth of your child you put $5,000 into an account earning 10% compound interest, by the time your child is out of high school, they will have over $30,000. That's enough to go to college, help with their first house payment, or pay for a big wedding. But think of this. If they let it sit until they're 60, they'd be a millionaire. Number six, don't pass up that 401k. There's no reason not to take advantage of your company's retirement plan if they offer one. A percentage of your salary is contributed each year before taxes are taken out, and oftentimes employers have matching. So a 401k is doubly wise. Number seven, get yourself started on an individual retirement account. Similarly, you can have a percentage of your annual income automatically deposited into a separate savings account, and it's not subject to income tax as long as you leave it there. It will be taxed once you withdraw. By the time you do, you'll be in a lower tax bracket saving money. Your IRA can be in a bank, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, or a self-directed one to invest in real estate. Number eight, open a Roth. A Roth IRA is similar to a regular IRA, but more conditions are met. You're used after-tax dollars, but then you withdraw tax-free. Number nine, patient. Be patient with the stock market. You always hear about people becoming millionaires overnight through the stock market, and it happens sometimes, but more often, the stock market is definitely a nuanced game that involves guaranteed rise and fall. But if you pull out and don't hold through and don't panic, you can slowly build a balanced portfolio and amass a fortune. And last but not least, many of the wealthiest Americans are frugal spenders, knowing where to spend their money and where to save it, treating themselves to some luxuries, but they don't overdo it. They use their money wisely so it doesn't run out, and that keeps it working for them. Now, fully and completely integrate these habits now. See yourself in this way. Look forward into the future and watch how differently people will respond to you. Imagine yourself with these successes already. Create some personal affirmations with these tools as well to reinforce what you have just integrated into your personality. And that is your Millionaire Minute. Now, she's still on top, and I quite can't figure out why, but I think she still is padding the numbers. But we have right now...
It's a need you gotta fail. It's news you gotta know. And news by the numbers is your favorite part of the show. Yeah.
Yes, Karen Gurm, the ever-popular, vivacious, good-looking, intelligent, articulate, and producer of this show, as well as segment host Karen Gurm, who is going to share with us what the markets have been doing this past week. Karen, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you, Heather. You're too kind.
Well, you know, it is what it is. You can't deny the truth. It ain't bragging if you done it.
Oh, stop.
Okay, I will. Tell us about the market.
Heather?
I'm ready when you are, sister.
Okay. Well, Heather, I wish I had good news, but unfortunately, jobs report pushes the stocks lower this week. Stocks suffered their first two-week loss since July after an ugly report on jobs showed the U.S. national unemployment hitting 9.8%. The Dow Jones Industrials closed down 22 points to 9,488. The NASDAQ Composite Index was off 9 points to 2,048, and the Standard & Poor's 500 Index was down 5 points at 1,025. For the week, the major averages dropped about 2%. The market's performance this week, the major averages fell for four straight days, may keep investors on edge next week. Earnings season will start with a number of key companies reporting, including fertilizer maker Mosaic, aluminum giant Alcoa, seed and chemical maker Monsanto, and soft drink giant PepsiCo. But the issues hanging over the market will be whether the economic recovery has started and how strong it will be. Friday's jobs report killed any thoughts that the economy will recover very quickly from the worst recession since World War II. Not only did the unemployment rate hit 9.8%, the highest since June of 1983, but non-farm payrolls fell by 263,000, more than analysts had expected. Worst average weekly hours worked fell to 33, matching an all-time low set in June, and the rate of workers unemployed working part-time when they want to work full-time and not looking for jobs hit 17%. And that is your News by the Numbers. I am Karen Grimm.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry you didn't have better news to share with us.
Me too. Hopefully soon.
Yes. Well, again, let's start looking for those shopping, holiday shopping numbers. That'll be interesting to see what happens there. Well, anyway, maybe next week will be better for us. Coming up next, we have our key guest, the world's fastest reader, right after this. You're listening to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. Stay tuned for the second half of our show with the Keys to Riches and our key guest coming up next.
Has your cell phone or iPod ever run out of battery before? Maybe you're somewhere without power, like fishing, camping, or the beach. Well, now you can have all the power you need. The K3 Charger by Kinesis Industries uses wind and sun to charge your devices anytime, day or night. Use the wind and sun to store up charging power, or charge your device right now on the spot. Available now for $99.95 at www.kinesisindustries.com. That's Kinesis, K-I-N-E-S-I-S, industries.com.
Hi, this is Melanie, and I'm part of Two for the Road USA. I'm the X from Boomer and X. I've been test driving cars for several years, but in the last 18 months, I found it difficult to get in and out of the test vehicles. I kept complaining the manufacturers didn't make the seats large enough until I realized it was me who was too large at 220 pounds. Thanks to the Diradori weight loss program, I lost 50 pounds. The Diradori program is physician-supervised, non-surgical, safe, and effective, and you can lose up to 5 to 10 pounds the first week and 15 to 20 in a month. I did. It controls hunger and trains your body to burn fat, all on an easy-to-follow regimen of exercise, hydration, and delicious, healthy eating. It is a three-phase program combining medication, nutrition, and exercise. This is an affordable program with counselors available at any time. I went from a size 20 to a size 10 in 7 months, and I feel like a different person. Check out my photos on twofortheroadusa.com. Click on Watch Melanie Lose Weight on Diradori. Call Diradori now at 480-661-9662.
Are you a referral partner of the Unlock Your Wealth radio program? Would you like to promote your products and your services on our show? Learn about the benefits that our featured advertisers receive being part of an exclusive program where the listeners are seeking financial independence and are in need of your insurance, finance, real estate, and investment services. Call now at 1-866-966-9420. 1-866-966-9420. Reach the people who need your help the most with the Unlock Your Wealth radio show today.
Karen Grimm here.
Hi, I'm Tony Stewart, driver of the number 14 Office Depot Old Spice Chevrolet, and you're listening to Heather Wagenhals on Unlock Your Wealth Radio.
Listen, folks, we talked a lot about money on this project, but we haven't talked about how crazy and how obsessed today's culture has gotten about money. So I would like to end this project with a warning. I'd like you to be careful. Be careful. Be careful not to love.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. I am so excited about our key guest this week because going along with become a voracious reader, one of the things that I have always enjoyed all my life was reading, and I've been so inspired and so hungry for knowledge that I always wanted to be able to get as much content as I could, as fast as I could,
And speed reading was one of the things that had interested me. And so I bought books and tapes on how to become a more effective reader and to be able to retain more information in a shorter period of time so I could expose myself to more content. And I know it kind of makes me a little bit of a nerd, I suppose, but I wanted... Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. I am so excited about our key guest this week because going along with Become a Voracious Reader, one of the things that I have always enjoyed all my life was reading, and I've been so inspired and so hungry for knowledge that I always wanted to be able to get as much content as I could, as fast as I could, and speed reading was one of the things that had interested me. And so I bought books and tapes on how to become a more effective reader and to be able to retain more information in a shorter period of time so I could expose myself to more content. And I know it kind of makes me a little bit of a nerd, I suppose, but I wanted to bring on the world's fastest reader. So in line with our key for this week, become a voracious reader, and you're thinking, I don't have time to read, I want to be able to give you some tools to maximize your ability to get as much content as you can in whatever limited time you have available. So this week we have Howard Berg on. He is recognized as the world's fastest reader thanks to cutting-edge accelerated learning techniques that he developed that turn information overload into information assets. He is respected internationally for his contribution to the learning process, and he is listed in the 1990 Guinness Book of World Records for reading more than 25,000 words a minute and writing more than 100 words a minute. So without any further delay or lengthy biography, I want you all to be able to see Howard Steven Berg himself. Howard, welcome to the broadcast.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm so excited that you're a part of the show today. One of the things that was so important to me, and if you heard before I introduced you, I love to read. I'm kind of a nerd, and I'm so hungry for knowledge, and there's so much out there. I've always just wanted to capture as much as I could. And so 20 years ago, well, more than 20, 25 years ago, because I'm going to be 40 this year, I stumbled onto the Evelyn Wood method of speed reading, did that program so I could be able to increase my ability to retain information, and I really enjoyed those techniques. I've kind of fallen off the wagon, so to speak, and I haven't really kept up with those skills. But when Howard, tell me, how did you get interested in speed reading?
Actually, it's a two-part answer. When I was younger, I grew up in Brooklyn. I live in Texas, but you may have detected I don't have a strong Texas accent. And the part of Brooklyn I grew up in had lots of gangs, and I found out very early in life that gang kids don't go to libraries. Somehow libraries are for gang kids what churches are for vampires. They just don't go. And, I mean, even to this day, have you ever been in a library and felt intimidated by the group of people hanging out reading books? So I got very good at reading. I had college reading in sixth grade because it wasn't safe to go out and play. And when I got to college, I majored in biology. And I remember it was in my junior year, and I got very interested in the brain and learning. And I told my advisor I wanted to do a dual major in bio and psych. It's a branch of bio called psychobiology, which is the biology of behavior. And they said, well, you won't be able to do that. You only have 1 year of college left. You have to do six science courses a term to do a four-year psych program in a year, and frankly, you're not smart enough. And that's when it hit me.
No one had ever put down the gauntlets like that and challenge you.
Yeah, that really got my ire up. That's all he had to say. I couldn't do it. And it's when I realized they never taught us how to learn in school. They tell you what to learn, why to learn, what will happen if you don't learn, but they don't explain why you can remember the words, I shot the sheriff, you don't even want to. And then you read something that actually has significance, and the next day you don't remember who wrote it and the title. So I started learning about learning. It's called metacognitive psychology, how we learn to learn. And I got up to 80 pages a minute, did a four-year psych program in a year. I actually got an 800 on the graduate record exam in biology. I went to 48 biology books in 3 nights, and then I went on and took a graduate course in educational psychology in 7 hours. I read the book 4 times. I took the 6-hour test in 50 minutes and got a B+. And that may sound good, but one of my students, Brad Voller, completed his 4-year college degree in 6 months and learned to speak Chinese fluently in 3 weeks and became a missionary using my program.
Wow, that's some impressive numbers.
I must be constantly...
And some amazing feats. And here with what we do on our program, we use the neuro-linguistic programming techniques to help people modify behavior when it comes to managing their finances. So I'm really big into how the brain works and behavior modeling and behavior modification techniques. So tell me what, you know, because I'm only familiar with the Evelyn Wood method of speed reading. Is yours similar to that, or do you take a completely different approach?
Probably the best way to answer that is say that the former president of Evelyn Woods has endorsed my program. His name is Doug Hall, and he and I have gotten to be very close friends. And Tommy Thompson was the chairman and CEO of Evelyn Woods, and he's given me permission and endorsed the program, as well as Barry Fowler, who invented Sylvan Learning. And one of the big differences, if you're familiar with that system, it was good for the time that it existed. But Fowler had several very fundamental problems. First, it was an all-or-nothing system. You either did fast reading all the time or none of the time. You couldn't sometimes read slowly and then pick it up and go quickly again. So it was all-or-nothing. And the reason was, speed reading was primarily a conditioned response to text. And so you can did a series of mechanical drills, conditioned yourself to fast reading, stopped doing the drills, or you stopped using the technique, you went back to where you were. I don't think reading... Yes, lots of people. In fact, in my opinion, I teach this in my program, reading is not learning. You could read a book and fail a test. You could read a book and do poorly at work. Most people think learning is how many pages they read or how many hours they study. It's irrelevant. What's relevant is did you understand and learn? So I put much, much, much more emphasis on learning. See, speed reading is excellent for getting the big picture. It's not very good for learning Chinese in 3 weeks. It's not very good for learning educational psychology in 7 hours. Study techniques are recognized to be the way to learn, but they're slow. They're cumbersome. It takes 90% of your time to find the 10% of the information you actually end up having to learn. And at that point, you don't have any time to learn it.
Yeah.
And memory techniques are outstanding for retaining, but what's the point of remembering something you don't understand or you misunderstood? What we've done is created a learning solution which combines the speed of speed reading, the learning skills of a study system, and the brain-based learning skills that would be used for memory and retention. So instead of using one screwdriver as the only tool in this toolbox, we've got a number of brain-based learning strategies that have been integrated into a total learning solution so people could actually learn medicine, law. I just had a 19-year-old pass the bar exam in California. You might say that's an unusual thing. His sister's 15. He's a first-year law student. His 17-year-old brother is a second-year law student. And his 22-year-old brother is an attorney and a flight instructor. And what we're doing is we're teaching people how to use these tools. So unlike Evelyn Woods, which was primarily speed reading, this is a system that uses reading as one of the many tools for learning. And by integrating it with learning tools and not just rapid speed, people are getting results that's never been seen. I'll give a good example. We had a 16-year-old graduate at the University of Texas Arlington, Stephen Terry. He actually graduated at 15. His mother made him go an extra year because he wasn't old enough to get a driver's license until he turned 16. He said, you can't go to graduate school until you're old enough to drive. When he turned 16, he graduated with a 4.0, an A-plus average, majored in economics, which is probably one of the toughest degrees you could get. Went to grad school. You do economics, so you know it. 18 years old, goes for his master's degree in math, graduates at 19 with a 3.97. It was his only B in his entire college career. It almost destroyed him. He didn't know how to handle a B because he's never gotten one before. And his big, yeah, I know. His biggest challenge in graduate school was he's a teaching assistant. He couldn't date undergraduates because he was a teaching assistant and he was 17. Who was he supposed to date? So his biggest problem is I don't know who to go out with.
Oh, my goodness.
These are great stories, and they're all true, and it makes me feel so good to know that I've played a role in these people's lives.
Oh, and the impact is exponential, you know, obviously, from what you've been able to create. I like how on your website you talk about how when we get into a car, we can drive and we assimilate millions of bits of information at any given time, and yet we wind up, the average person reads it 200 words a minute with super low comprehension. Why is it that way? What, you know, and I, in my personal opinion about learning is that, that people have stigmatized learning with not being cool. And I was talking yesterday on our midweek update that we need to make smart the new sexy. But why is it easier to do to take in millions of bits of information at 70 miles an hour than it is to read a book?
Let me ask both questions about people thinking that smart isn't good. I wonder how much they're enjoying unemployment. Maybe that's a lot more fun, because my experience is people who know more, who are able to do more, who adapt quicker and learn faster, make more money and have more opportunities than people who only know how to wash a cup. They pay neuroscience.
A lot of millionaires are at least four-year degree graduates.
There you go. But to answer your other question, when we're driving in a car, we see everything as a movie. And our brain takes the information in an analog mode. Everything comes in as pictures. When we're reading in a book, there's a little person in back of our head pronouncing one word at a time. We hear a book. We don't see a book. Now, the reason most people read about 200 words a minute is that's how fast most people speak. They read at their speaking speed. They hear the voice. By teaching them to see the movie in the book that they're using when they're walking in a mall, seeing faces that they know, from thousands of faces, or when they're driving on the road in their car, by teaching them to turn on that same perceptual mechanism they use with everything but reading, a normal average person, we actually did an efficacy study, an average person can go about 100% to 400%, most people double, in about 4 hours. We did a Nelson Denny. We had a group of researchers. I wasn't there. We wanted it to be completely non-biased. So they used my program as the teaching instrument. They gave them the Nelson Denny, which is a reading diagnostic test, tested their speed and comprehension before and after the exam using the Nelson Denny, which is a standardized test. And the average person was about 100% or greater with equal or better comprehension. And that's the key, because you're asking what's the difference between what I do and others. I put the emphasis on the comprehension, not the speed. I don't care how fast people are flipping through pages and not learning. I'm interested in seeing people be able to read things that help them to be successful and retain it. I'd rather see someone double and get an A, or be able to make a better investment because they understand the information clearer, than have them reading five times faster and not remember anything they learned.
Well, anybody can regurgitate facts, but to be able to apply them in a method that makes sense is really the essence. And that's what I liked when I started looking at all the different things in your program, and I thought, wow, you know,
yes.
I have a 12-year-old stepson who could listen or watch one episode of that Family Guy and regurgitate it verbatim, but you ask him to read two pages in a homework book, and he's completely disinterested. So I know he has the aptitude to learn. It's just that, you know, sometimes people have to be taught how to learn. They need to learn how to learn because they're not ever taught that. And it would seem to me that that would be a fundamental tenet of education, is to first teach people how to learn and then let them learn.
Very good point. If they ever had a dumbed down a Sony Wii game, you know, I just was hired by Sony to be their national spokesperson for their e-reader. You may have seen me on TV with Justin Timberlake and Peyton Manning and Amy Sedaris talking about this program. So you're right. They've never had a dumbed down a game, a Game Boy game or a Wii game or any of these other. Kids are perfectly able to learn, except you can almost see the plugs coming out when they go to their textbooks, when their brain starts slowing down. And I'm going to tell you why it happened. They're not teaching them how to learn. You're right, they should, but they don't. There's actually three kinds of learning: literal, implied, and inferential. And the way we teach this in my program is using something we call the dime story, and I thought I could share that with our listeners. I'm going to ask you to tell me what a dime looks like, literally. This is literal learning. If I asked you to describe a dime, what would you say?
A dime is round. It has a picture on both sides, and it has ridges around the edge.
Good. How interesting was this, truthfully?
Not very.
About as interesting as school is for most of the kids and adults that go. They get words on a page, they don't know what to look for, they don't know what to do with it, and they don't know why they need to know it. They just said learn it. That's literal learning. You're just learning what's on the page. You have no motivation, no goals. You're just shoving information into your head, and it's emptying out as fast as you put it in. Second level learning is called implied learning. I'm going to ask you a question now about the dime. Tell me something you could do with a dime other and spend it as money. I'd like our listeners to think about this, too, while you're responding.
Well, I've been pretty crafty. You can use it as a fat screwdriver when you don't have one.
Yes. And you could, what, anything else? I could help you.
Use it as a shim. I've used it as a
yes.
tool.
So. Yes, a tool, a shim, a screwdriver, a scratch-off, mark a golf putt. You can flip it. You could toss it. You could trace a circle. So notice we've shifted gears. We went from tell me what it looks like to what have you done with a dime? What might you do you never thought about doing? What have you seen someone else do? You had to think. You had to analyze. You had to reflect. Your brain shifted gears. It's a lot more interesting than it's flat and silver and got ridges. Now I'm going to actually tell you there's a story behind the dime. This is inferential learning. When did you know there's a significance to the dime? And here's what it is. You're right, there's a face on it. And that face isn't a coincidence. It's Franklin Roosevelt. Roosevelt got polio when he was 38. It almost killed him. So he started a not-for-profit to raise money for polio research because 1 in 8 people had polio. It was 13% of the children. And so they called the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. And they funded their work with birthday parties. Every year on his birthday, they had a party and they raised money. But even with his help, there wasn't enough money. Along came Eddie Cantor. Like you, he had a radio show. But back then, radio was television. And he had millions of listeners. And he told people on his show, send your pocket change to the president. His friends, Al Jolson, Gracie Allen, George Burns, and many others, did the same thing on their show. So they raised over 2.6 million dimes for polio research. And Eddie Cantor coined the phrase, the March of Dimes to Washington. And they used that money. Jonas Salk got the money, found the cure for polio. Who better to put on the U.S. dime when they changed it from a mercury head dime than Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the March of Dimes to help to find a cure for polio. Now, this is inferential learning. Did you notice how more interesting and emotional it was? And if I asked you right now to tell me something about a dime, would you remember Roosevelt and polio and Eddie Cantor and March of Dimes? And couldn't you write 2 or 3 pages right now about a dime with no notes and no memory trick? See, that's the difference. You see the difference between it's round and it's silver and you could flip it and actually understanding why it is the way it is. That's what's missing in learning. When people learn how to do what I'm doing in books that they need to know, they get more out of it, their kids get better grades, let's face it, in today's information-driven economy, if people want to unlock their wealth, they have to stay on top of a ton of information. What was true in the morning could be totally different by afternoon because of events that are taking place. And if you're able to stay on top of that information stream that doubles every 6 months, you're going to lose a lot of money. And that's exactly what we see happening now in our country. People aren't able to keep up. You hear there aren't any jobs? That's not true. There's a surplus.
Oh, I know. I've been trying to hire for a year now, and I can't seem to. So, in my opinion, the economy must be fabulous, and we must be at full employment because nobody wants to come and work here. I've got tons of jobs and nobody to do them. So,
yeah, people come from all over. I was going to say one thing. You know, people come from all over the world to be doctors and nurses. We need to train our people who are out of work how to learn so they can get the skills they need to become doctors and nurses and so many other critical positions. The positions are there. They pay well. There's a shortage. People are desperate trying to have a living. The only thing blocking their success is their lack of learning skills.
Well, Howard, what are the five things that everybody must learn in order to master materials?
That's a good question. When people get texts, they often look at it and say, there's too much, I don't know what I'm supposed to look for. And there's only five things you really need to know. The new words, the vocabulary, which is 80% of learning any subject is vocabulary. The names, the people that are mentioned in the book. The numbers of dates, depending on the type of book. In an economics text, it would probably be numbers. In a history book, it's more likely dates. The headings or headers that separate the material from one section to another, that break it into pieces, and the questions. If you knew every word, every name, every important number and statistic, if you know the four key things learned in every section of the text, and the answers to every question, what else do you think you'd need to know? We developed a way to do this on the computer, and we taught this to a group of 11 to 15-year-olds, and they were able to complete a 30-chapter text in lifelong developmental psychology, which is a sophomore college text, in 1 week. 15 of the 18 students passed the CLEP, C-L-E-P, for full credit in a single week. It's an extremely powerful tool, and those are the five things you want to learn. Words, names, numbers, the main ideas in each section, and the answers to questions.
When I was younger, I used to always go read the questions first so I knew what I was looking for.
And that's why you're a success.
Well, thank you. I always felt, well, I could read this, and then I'm going to read the questions, and I'm going to have to go back and look up the information. So I figured I was more just lazy, I guess, and trying. You know how laziness can breed ingenuity. So I would figure, well, instead of reading it twice, I'll read the questions and then figure out what I need to know, and then I'm looking for the information that's important, and then the other part that's superfluous can just go over my head. So,
you're actually on something very... Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No,
I was going to say you're on something very important.
Well, learning is... Gosh, you know, we're at such a struggle, especially with the financial literacy in this country, and trying to get people to talk about money in the right ways, not just how do I spend it, who's going to give it to me next, and get rid of this entitlement mentality and get people to understand that they're responsible for their financial future, and they can only do that through education. And how can we utilize the tools that you have on your website, not just for better learning, but what can the better and more economical use of time learning with your methods enhance the rest of our lives? Not just about less time studying and passing exams, but kind of talk about what the big picture and the value of being able to comprehend information in shorter periods of time can do for us overall.
Sure. Well, let me mention that the website's called MrReader.com, MrReader.com. It's a blog, and there's lots of free information, as you said, on learning. And we also have a number of learning tools available as well that your audience will probably find very useful in their day-to-day work. What we're doing is we're teaching people a suite of systems, learning by analyzing, by reading, by learning how to be creative and get into flow, by learning how to output it into reports and learning how to speak intelligently. I'll give a really good, solid example. We took a group of 11 to 15-year-olds, and one of the children in this group, we have our own school called the New American School. And these kids wanted to raise money for Downs research because one of the children in the group, her brother had Downs, and the mice are very expensive. So they made a mouse as a product out of felt and sent it to China where it was built and shipped. They made a website themselves in Front Page. And we taught them public speaking using Toastmasters. And using the learning tools, they were able to learn all these different things. Now, they went on Fox and NBC and spoke for Rotaries and Lions. And one year, these kids, aged 11 to 15, made $93,000 for Dow's research. And they won the Silver Pyramid. Some of your listeners may realize what that is. The Silver Pyramid is the Oscar or the Emmy in advertising. So they didn't win it as kids. They won it as the best not-for-profit business plan in America. So you're 11 years old. Your first year in business, you made $93,000 and won the Academy Award. You're completely right. People need to stop worrying about getting jobs. They need to learn how to build companies. We live in a capitalist culture. It doesn't teach capitalism. We tell people from the time you're little, go to school and get a job. People come from all over the world with capitalist skills. They can't speak English. And in 5 years, they're multimillionaires. People live in this country their whole life, and they haven't got a clue how to start a business, which is disgraceful. There's so much opportunity out there for people who understand what to do and how to do it. That's why a show like yours is so important. You're teaching these skills to people. Instead of worrying about getting a job, find a way to build your own company. It isn't rocket science. It doesn't take a PhD. All it takes is some knowledge. And that's why you need to learn how to learn, by learning how to read faster and study smarter, by learning how to analyze and apply information inferentially. You could start your own company. Instead of worrying about getting a job, you can build your own business. You'll probably like the boss a whole lot better when it's you.
I know I do. I love her boss. She's great. She drives a hard bargain, but the rewards are worth it. You know, I grew up here in Arizona, and I was really fortunate to be in a public school system that recognized gifted kids. And I was always, my brother and I were super high IQ kids right out of the gate. And since I can remember in kindergarten, I'd go to kindergarten for part of my time, and then I would go to another class where, like, I had all these mind-expanding and enrichment programs. That's what they called them. They called them the enrichment programs. And I think that there's an affinity for kids who want to learn and are hungry to learn, that they're just going to do well anyway. But wouldn't it make sense, I guess this is a greater good kind of question I'm asking, but wouldn't it make sense to teach the kids that are the remedial students and the ones that have difficulty learning these techniques to bring them up to speed with everybody else?
We actually had a good example of what happens when you do that. We had a young lady, Amy, I won't give her last name, but she had third grade reading in the ninth grade. She was in special ed. When we got done with her, we had her college reading level in 6 weeks. She ended up getting her associate's degree with a 4.0 from Cedar Valley Community College, went to Baylor University on a full scholarship. Now, this is at the time the kids in high school got a high school degree. She finished her associate's with an A, went to Baylor on a full scholarship, had her bachelor's in speech pathology in 18 months and a master's at 22. She was basically told she was going to get a job welcome to Walmart because that was where her skill set was. Now, I'm not saying every student who has those problems is going to have those results. They're not. Amy had something very special. She cared. She knew that she had no future. She knew that if she didn't do something to fix it, she would have no life. And she was willing to apply herself and do what it took to be able to succeed. And that, to me, is more important than how smart you are. When you have motivation and you have drive and you're willing to do what you need to, you can accomplish amazing things. You may start off with difficulties, but you can turn those into inspiration and help you become successful. And, of course, if people want more of these research tools and learning systems, they can go to the Mr. Reader blog as well, because in addition to the tools we have some wonderful tools that they'll find, not just for themselves, but their kids. It doesn't matter whether you get it so you can be more successful at business. The only difference between your children and yourself is you'll read a spreadsheet and they'll read Harry Potter. But reading, studying, learning, it doesn't change. It's age indifferent. I just taught my 9-year-old grandkids how to speed read. One of them's at 770 words a minute and the other is at 370. To put it in perspective, most adults read about 200. They're 9 years old.
Yeah, that's cranking because, you know, I was lucky when I was at my best, I was about, you know, 700, you know, 800 because I just didn't have the time to continue with the drills and things. So I'm very interested in learning your techniques because I'm always hungry to learn, and there's only so much time in my day outside of my business where I can read. And I need to maximize my time so I have the comprehension level there, not just the getting through the material, but actually retaining something. We're getting kind of close to the end of our time, so I just have a couple more questions for you. You touched on it a moment ago when you were talking about your Amy example, and I know that there are kids that were not as brilliant as myself who were always hungry and driven and refuse to give up. And one of, I think, that my things isn't because I've been so smart, but I've just been doggedly determined. And my drive and my resiliency, like if you push me down, I'm going to get back up, and I'm going to keep getting back up. And you can keep pushing me down all you want, but someday I'm going to get past you because I just refuse to give in. And I think that plays along with a different part of our brain, not just our ability to absorb and retain information, but that hunger and desire. And what do you think your role or the role of emotional intelligence plays in success? And then answer the question first that way, and then how do we couple that with your tools to be exponentially more successful?
The latest studies suggest that your EQ or emotional intelligence is a better predictor of your success than your IQ. People who are brilliant but obnoxious, lack people skills, often don't work well with other people, and as a result, fail to perform to their full potential. We've all met the weird guy that knows a lot but nobody likes him because they're obnoxious. They're too much into
the meeting.
Yeah, go to a Mensa meeting. I have a very high IQ, and I deal with everybody. I treat people with respect. I don't care if you're 7 years old or 97 years old. People deserve to be talked to with respect and treated with dignity. And when you get nervous taking a test, what does that do to your performance? Or tired when you're taking a licensing exam, a certification exam, it's 5-6 hours long. Many people, by the third or fourth hour, all they can think is, I want to go home now. I don't care anymore. What does it do to their performance? So we teach them. Remember, I'm a psychobiologist. We teach people in my program emotional intelligence skills so that they can create the emotional state necessary for success. In fact, remember that Apollo 13 movie? And the main astronaut, when everybody was screaming at each other, it's your fault, no, it's your fault, he says, who cares whose fault it is? What are we going to do about it to get home alive? He stayed focused. He didn't get involved in incriminations and getting angry. He realized that they were going to die. If they didn't figure out what to do and stay focused, they were all going to die. And he was more interested in living than worrying about whose fault it was. It didn't matter. He had good EQ. He was able to pull it off. Nobody thought they'd survive. But his emotional intelligence, his ability to stay focused on the problem and working on solutions under the worst situation imaginable, getting stranded and out of space for eternity. What a horrible thing to experience. Most of us would have fallen apart. This man stayed focused. That's what EQ is about. It's the ability to deal with the situation and deal with it rationally and find the answers to the problems and be at our peak performance. And I don't care how smart you are or how much you learn, if your emotions are out of whack, it's going to impact you in a very bad way.
If you, because we're coming to the close of our time together, how unfortunate it is, because I'm really enjoying chatting with you. What one thing can we leave our listeners with that probably would be the most beneficial piece of information that they can take out of today's discussion?
Your brain has 10 to the 800th power connection. There is more computing power in your brain than all the atoms in the universe. It can make more connections than all the atoms in the universe, all the matter, all the energy, or the dark energy, or the dark matter. It's a phenomenally powerful apparatus, and no one ever teaches us how to use it, how to put it to good application in our day-to-day world. What I've done is created a program that teaches you how to unlock your thinking ability so you can unlock your wealth. And if people would like to go to MrReader.com, there's a ton of free videos and free PDF files that you can read, and there's some of the most powerful learning tools on the planet available there, not just for you to use, but to share with your family and your relatives so that we can make a better future. I mean, when you look at the world today, dwindling resources, dwindling energy, global warming, terrorism, what are we giving our kids? Trillions of dollars in deficit. Shouldn't we at least teach them how to be smart enough to make better choices than we did? And shouldn't we be people how to learn so they can have better lives and more opportunities in a time when it's challenging? People who are smarter and make better choices will have a better chance of being successful and unlocking their wealth than people that are in a panic mode and don't know what to do next. So I really hope that they'll listen to what we said, and I know after they're done listening, they'll go to the website, sign up for the free newsletter, look at some of the programs, and start learning some of the free things immediately. And I look forward to helping them and their families unlock their wealth by unlocking their mental computing power.
Well, we are so grateful that you are taking time out of your weekend to be a part of our broadcast, Howard. And I thank you so much for participating in the show. For those people who are interested and are driving around right now and didn't have a chance to write down MrReader.com, you can always click through our website on our previous guests and get the information at www.unlockyourwealth.com. We will have more with Keys for Teens and Nuts and Bolts coming up right after this.
Like, has your cell phone or iPod ever totally run out of battery before? Maybe you're somewhere without power, like fishing, camping, or the beach. Now you can have all the power you need. The K3 Charger by Kinesis Industries uses wind and sun to charge your devices anytime, day or night. Use the wind and sun to store up charging power, or charge your device right on the spot. Available now! For $99.95 at www.kinesisindustries.com. That's Kinesis, K-I-N-E-S-I-S, Industries.com. Like, go there, totally!
Hi, this is Melanie, and I'm part of Two for the Road USA. I'm the X from Boomer and X. I've been test driving cars for several years, but in the last 18 months, I found it difficult to get in and out of the test vehicles. I kept complaining the manufacturers didn't make the seats large enough until I realized it was me who was too large at 220 pounds. Thanks to the Diradori weight loss program, I lost 50 pounds. The Diradori program is physician-supervised, non-surgical, safe, and effective, and you can lose up to 5 to 10 pounds the first week and 15 to 20 in a month. I did. It controls hunger and trains your body to burn fat, all on an easy-to-follow regimen of exercise, hydration, and delicious, healthy eating. It is a three-phase program combining medication, nutrition, and exercise. This is an affordable program with counselors available at any time. I went from a size 20 to a size 10 in 7 months, and I feel like a different person. Check out my photos on twofortheroadusa.com. Click on Watch Melanie Lose Weight on Diradori. Call Diradori now at 480-661-9662.
Karen Gurm here. You probably recognize me as your segment host for News by the Numbers. Did you know I am also one of the certified NLP practitioners and a financial coach here at the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation? The most successful people in life have coaches to guide them along their chosen path. Tiger Woods, Michael Jordan, Tony Stewart, Tom Hopkins, Robert Kiyosaki all had coaches. Whether it was their father, someone else's father, or another person who helped them to shape their desires into an achievable path to success with a system of accountability where quitting was the only way to fail. Each of these people had someone who didn't see them as they first were, but as the person inside they knew they could easily become. Financial coaching can be the single addition you need to become financially independent. Call the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation now for your free consultation. 1-866-966-9420. 1-866-966-9420. Or visit us on the web at www.unlockyourwealth.com.
Even in today's economy, I, Count Dracula, have had to foreclose on my castle. But because of Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio, I have not only reacquired my castle, but I have opened a resort for the undead. Tune in to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. She's the only one not trying to suck you dry.
Here I am. Oh, you thought I wouldn't show up? You thought you could take your credit cards, live beyond your means, spend all you want, not budget a plan, and avoid me? I'm your worst nightmare, baby. Do you know who I am? My first name is Bad, last name is Dead. I promise you, I'm the one that you'll never forget.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. You are listening to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. And we are closing in on the broadcast, putting it to bed, the last key for the season. And we've been talking about becoming a voracious reader. And I want to, before we get any further into the key, I want to get into keys for teens and welcome our segment hostess, Alyssa. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Heather. How are you today?
Oh, I'm great. I'm thawing out because it's a little cold up here.
Yeah, I heard. It's really nice. It's supposed to be 77 today, so I'm
How's
excited.
How's Taylor going?
It's really good. I'm not swamped with work so much this week because I already took all my first round of tests, so hopefully this will be a nice week, this next coming one. So I'm looking forward to an enjoyable weekend.
Maybe you can use some of Howard Berg's techniques on reading and maybe help improve your ability to study so you don't have to spend as much time studying. You can go have more fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to looking deeper into that. So that will be a great tool to have for the rest of my 4 years here. I can't believe we are at the end of the line.
I know.
Become a voracious reader. Between starting college, which is a different type of schooling altogether, and going through the keys each week, I feel like a completely different person. This week's key for me, at least, is an easy one since I always read and enjoy reading to improve my ability to learn, communicate, and grow. But I would imagine that there is a good portion of other teens that can't wait to get out of school because they probably feel like they will never have to read again. That attitude is completely wrong, and I believe that will be their downfall. At least for now, it seems that will be the case. Ask me in 20 years what I think about reading and its impact, and we shall see if my opinion has changed.
Well, as someone who is more than 20 years older than you, I can say most definitely my ability to read and to continue to grow my knowledge has been what's been my focal point of success. One of the greatest things about this key and become a voracious reader and why it's so important to make all the others work is, you know, you will achieve tremendous success if you apply the skills you learn with the keys to riches. But the value in becoming a voracious reader is I'm just one point of view. I know that I am not the be-all, end-all when it comes to money management. And as time goes by, there are significant fundamentals that won't change. But there are other things, different types of investments, different styles of investing, different levels of risk, that will evolve as time passes. Investments are different today than they were yesterday, and they'll be more different tomorrow. What to invest in, how or why to invest in it. That's always going to be a work in progress. One of the values of continuing to read is a few things. One, it's going to increase your knowledge about a particular subject, no question. Number two, when you read great writing, it increases your ability to think more clearly, more cohesively, and then as a result of that, you'll be able to communicate your thoughts more effectively. And that's the one thing that I think that made such a difference, because I've never made any attempt to dissuade you otherwise. I did not finish college. I had to go to work to take care of my family. And I had to drop out, and I've always meant to go back. But because I didn't finish college, I have always felt like there was something wrong with me, that there was a black spot on my record because I didn't have a college degree. And therefore, I felt that in order to be competitive or to get ahead of everyone else, I had to know more, understand more, and be able to think at a higher and faster level in order to beat out those college graduates who would get a job just because they had that piece of paper. And that is what drove me to read. And I am a monster fan of nonfiction. I enjoy reading, and I like to, you know, to think. That's why I like nonfiction so much. So if I do read fiction, I only read like mysteries and things where I can solve, where the wheels start turning, where I'm hungry to continue to know more. And otherwise, I stick to nonfiction myself. And I have always read, and I was always a big seminar junkie, and I always went to success seminars and personal development seminars. And I remember Jim Rohn said, if you can read three books in any area, you're probably going to know more than the smartest person in that area. And if you read a book a week for 10 years in your area of expertise, nobody could ever touch your level of knowledge or understanding on a subject. And so my goal has always been to read a book a week. And let me just tell you from personal experience that even though I had never finished, and I shouldn't say never because never say never, but I haven't finished my college degree yet, but it has not been my downfall because I continued to learn. And that's the value of becoming a voracious reader. Because people think when they get out of college, that's it, and they stop learning. And then you just go to work, and then they're working for the man, and they get this dogged mentality. And you've got to always be increasing your knowledge, whether you graduate from college or not, whether you had to get a GED out of high school and go to work because your family situation dictated so. That doesn't mean you're stuck there forever. And that's what the value of reading does. It enriches your comprehension, your ability to make decisions, your ability to assimilate facts and to learn. And that's what makes me so excited about Howard Berg's system, and I'm going to totally go and buy one this afternoon because I want to be able to get into higher comprehension at that faster reading level. And that's the one thing. And the other system I did, if I didn't stay up with the daily skills, I lost it. And that's why becoming a voracious reader is so important. And for today's nuts and bolts, for those of you who are just joining us for the first time, the Keys to Riches is a baker's dozen of financial concepts that not only teach you how to think like the rich and be in control of your own money, but also gives you specific techniques to create or fix your credit, reduce debt, save and invest, building wealth through real estate, all while transforming your current financial habits into healthy money management skills. And we do this through the nuts and bolts. Now that we have the overview of what the key is, here's how we're going to apply it. This week's key statement is, I know that to truly get ahead in today's instant information age, I must constantly be reading and learning new ways to evaluate and integrate that information so I may enjoy a lifetime of continued financial success. This week's affirmation is, I have excellent reading and comprehension skills. They both go together, reading and comprehension skills. Now, we use our affirmations every day to convince our subconscious and that little inner curmudgeon that we are worthy of the goals that we have set forth about in our conscious life. So we say our affirmations before we go to bed to get our conscious or subconscious mind focusing on those ideas. And then all night while we sleep and restore ourselves, our brain is creating new neural pathways to solve the how do we get to these things when we understand the why. Then when we first wake up in the morning, we reread our affirmations so we can focus on them and get our conscious mind focusing on our current and long-term goals. And then anytime we encounter negativity throughout the day, we're going to pull out our affirmations and we're going to read them again, whether it's from a spouse, a coworker, subordinate, employer, customer, student, a child, or a parent of ours. We're going to pull these affirmations out and retrain our brain to not focus on the negative event that just occurred, but on our greater purpose in life, which is fulfilling these affirmations. And this week's key action item is find one new book or blog to begin reading about creating financial independence and one new book or tool that you can read. And I suggest you go to MrReader.com to figure out how to learn how to learn. Learn how to learn. It can be the best thing that you do for yourself for your entire life and all facets of it. I want to thank you all for joining us this week on the broadcast. Next season, we are going to have brand new fun things for you. We're so excited about what we're doing with the website and the show for next season. So, if you are not a subscriber to the E-Zine, you need to do so now. E-Zine at unlockyourwealth.com or visit the website www.unlockyourwealth.com. And you will find links to our current hosts. Thanks to all of our guests that we had on this week. What an incredible show. And if you'd missed the midweek update, we had Johnny Diaz, who is the financial literacy through music, and he is our new bumper music that you keep hearing, Mr. Bad Debt and all of that. Download and listen to that broadcast. Thanks for all of our segment hosts for their participation, for Karen Gurm for putting together yet another fabulous broadcast with incredible guests. And I did not give you the trivia question this week, so it's going to roll over into Wednesday's broadcast. It slipped my mind with all of the excitement of today's guests. So thank you again for joining us this week. Look for a new season next week as we start over with the first key in the Keys to Riches, acceptance and affirmation. Also, join in on Wednesdays at 11 Pacific Standard Time for the midweek update. It's your 30-minute shot in the arm to get you where you need to be, and that is on the road to financial independence. Thanks again for listening. This has been Heather Wagenhals, Unlock Your Wealth Radio. Have a great week.
I've had it up to here, listening to a small segment of people trying to put down America. America's the greatest land on earth, and we ought to be proud of what we have. I'm proud of America. I'm proud of our people, and I'm going to prove it. We're American and damn proud of it.
Frankly, I'm getting a little ticked off.
Go to hell.